Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Lancaster Theological Seminary. Welcome back to many of you. We're delighted that you're here this morning for our historic second Swander Macaulay lecture for spring 2010. As you know, the first was Dr. Valerie Bridgman, and today we have another of our two new faculty members giving Swander Macaulay lecture. Dr. Derek S. Hicks, who is Assistant Professor of Religion and Culture. And for those who are guests, though I see many familiar faces here, let me just pause to introduce myself. I'm Edwin Aponte, Vice President of Academic Affairs and Dean of the Seminary. And in that role, I'm delighted to introduce our colleague, Dr. Hicks, who received his BA from Grambling State University, an MA in Biblical Studies from Dallas Theological Seminary, a PhD recently, not even a year ago yet. So much has happened. PhD in 2009 from the Religious Studies Department at Rice University in Houston, Texas. Dr. Hicks' interdisciplinary research examines the intersections of religion and culture in the United States, which I, as a professor of religion and culture, thoroughly approve his doing. His major areas of study include African-American religion with a primary research interest in the function of religion among racially oppressed peoples. And this gives him a wide range of areas to focus, including African-American religious thought and experience, race and religion in the United States, slavery and Christianity, various theories and in hermeneutics, black religious aesthetics, black and liberation theologies, and sociology of religion. His dissertation was entitled Making the Wounded Whole, An Investigation of Healing and Identity in African American Religious Life and Thought. This is in process, has been revised, and look forward to on the shelves within a year. We hope so, and we are praying. His work identifies religious practices that engage culture in relation to bodily, political, spiritual, and social restoration while forming a theological thrust that fuels black Christianity. His work has been recognized in many ways, and he has received fellowship support from the Ford Foundation, the Fund for Theological Education, and more recently, and this is news to others, and we'll give you more details on it, from the Louisville Institute. Dr. Hicks' lecture this morning is entitled, What Meaneth This? Social, Political Death, Religion and Culture in the Age of an Obama Presidency. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Derek Hicks.
Well, good morning. For those of you who are sitting, I'm anticipating where my late wife, well, that didn't come out right. Stated differently. My wife, who is this morning late in her arrival, I'm anticipating where she might sit. And so you will let her know the glowing things, how I spoke glowingly of her to all of you this morning. But you will please refrain from telling her that I called her my late wife. But I just want to say thank you all for being here this morning, whether you were asked to come, forced to come, or came on your own free will. Most notably, I thank the president, Dr. Reese Potterveld. I thank my dean, my boss, my mentor. Both Reese and Ed are my mentors, but I thank Ed Aponte. Whoever is here from the Board of Trustees, thank you for being here, my colleagues, students, friends. I feel like I'm in the church. It's just good to be in this house. But it's good to be here this morning. Whenever you have an opportunity to share your work, it is, in essence, an opportunity to share of yourself. We labor long and hard over what we do. Dr. Peter Heltzel, who is among us, and I'll say a quick word about him, who is the professor, assistant professor of theology at New York Theological Seminary. If you could raise your hand, I'm shamelessly plugging him because he's written an outstanding book and an important and a timely book called Jesus and Justice, Evangelicals, Race, and American Politics. This is a white guy speaking out against whiteness, as it were. So I think it's important. I wanted to pause because he will be speaking in my class this evening at 6:30. So for any of you who would like to come out to L204 this evening, he will be offering. He spoke to my class this morning directly on his book, and he will be offering reflections on his book and other things later on. My wife is in the building, so I've killed enough time so that I can acknowledge her shortly. My wife and my son are in the building, who is being a good little boy inside the womb right now. So he will be quiet. My other girls would not be, so they're not here. But anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge his presence and thank him for being here this morning. This is kind of a continuing conversation from what we had this past weekend. I also want to, therefore, acknowledge my wife, who is here. She does not get to see me kind of do my thing all that often. This past weekend, she was supporting my efforts here by not only taking care of our own children, because our babysitters were also here working, Miss Jana and Andrea, but also she took care of Dr. Yolanda Pierce's child as well. So I want to thank my wife for being just that, an undergirder, a supporter, a strong advocate for what I do, for loving me through those times when I'm not around, for loving me through those times when I am, when I come home, have dinner, play with the kids, and then have to come back to the office or go to Prince Street Coffee to get a little bit more work done. This has been a year of significant happenings for me academically and professionally, and so I hope to restore some time later on, perhaps next year, where I won't be doing as much as I was doing this year. So thank you. I love you. Thanks for being here. Alrighty, I'm just going to go ahead and jump on into this. You have heard the title, What Meaneth This? Socio-Political Death, Religion, and Culture in the Age of an Obama Presidency. As we marinate on that for a moment. Let me begin as if a cultural critic and reflect on this wondrous age of posts. It may be fruitful within this reflection to consider the paramount post of our time, that is, the post of post-race. You know, this wonderfully blended, dare I say, gray society, where everybody comes together. There remains no reason to neither assess nor even consider issues of race, racial categories, or even the big R among them, racism itself. We are all the same under the eyes of God. This is what I hear. We have finally moved toward the sacrosanct realm of the great American melting pot, ushered in by an Obama presidency. Yet I remain more of a gumbo man myself. And if anyone knows good gumbo, you know that it isn't a melting pot at all. It is a complex brew of flavors oddly coming together to form an exquisite experience of taste. And so, let us, for a moment, and along this line of thought, strap on our cultural critic lenses and consider the complex or the gumboness within this neatly comprised post-race era. For instance, over the last year or so, this post-race dispensation, we have witnessed the most death threats of our president or of any president in history, each threat is infused with some form of racially driven language. For $9.99, we were told we can purchase a T-shirt from Christian organizations with scripture calling for prayer for our president. Of course, that is the prayer of his death while he's in office. I overhear folks converse at local coffee houses stating that they were never before in favor of term limits until this abomination. We've seen the rise in militia membership, which we were just discussing in my class with Dr. Heltzel, and a surge in this Tea Party movement. We've heard the chatter about rumors of race wars or even another civil war. But I ask, what will be the field of battle? What are the ideological lines? But the example that hits closest to home relates to my daughter's school. On the cover of their most recent and frankly beautiful promo booklet, I don't have one here, but I have one in my office, one finds two high school-aged boys, one black and one white, talking, having a conversation. From the photo, it looks as though the black boy is explaining something to the other student. This promotional booklet was sent to all local grandparents of current students. One grandparent, upon seeing the booklet cover, sent their copy back to the school with a note saying, and I quote, "The front of your magazine turned me off. I did not even open it. There is more to this country than Obama," end quote. Without knowing whether or not this respondent was white or black, although based upon the student body of the school, we can easily draw a conclusion about whether or not he or she was white or black. It seems, at least to this person, that our post-race society and culture is a bit too much to take. This person's statements reflect tensions in this country about race. They reveal the dis-ease with post-race idea on both sides. Those who want to maintain the old status quo of inequality, and those who want to fight against inequality by any means necessary. I am led thusly to inquire, what exactly does it mean to be in this new post-race era? Have we constrained our perceptions of race and racial difference? Are we seeking to compress all bodies, that is, physical flesh bodies, into a single category, making the issue of race obsolete? What would be the nature of existence or cultural exchange within such a compressed box? Or does it simply mean what so many advocates of this post-race notion try to compel others to believe, that race simply no longer matters, that our country is finally disconnected from the stained past of oppression? Of course, without renouncing or even acknowledging the systemic oppression, that systemic oppression ever existed, and that the marker of this post-race society is inextricably tied to the extraordinary social economic gains that so many black and brown peoples of this country now share. The Obama presidency thus becomes a cheap catchphrase, a usable linguistic starting point to the post-race claim. Unfortunately, as things go, stories are rarely that easy to tell. Other potent realities often lurk within the crevices and the margins, making our stories a bit messier. Perhaps a post-race society would have more positive import if we were to simultaneously cast it as a post-racist society. Maybe sociologist Michael Emerson's concept of racialization in relation to white-black evangelical divide in churches is a more useful starting point. For Emerson, within racialized society, racism need not be overt or empirical. The dangerous assumption becomes this: because overt forms of racism have declined, racism itself has declined. But the insidious nature of racialization only begins to come into focus at the initial level of overt, covert discourse. What it keenly uncovers is the notion that values and institutions, sometimes unwittingly but too often intentionally, recreate the racial division that inequities that they claim to oppose. As a result, post-racers, as it were, in covert fashion, will promote a certain set of values. They will avoid direct racial terminology or in-depth conversations about race and racism. In a racialized society, we hear statements like, "I don't see color," which I hear a lot from my white evangelical friends. Even from well-meaning people, without realizing that the true societal beauty resides in its complex, its mixed-up, gumbo-like formulation. What, it seems to me, is missed in all of this post-race talk is the reality that the referent community yet remains a blues people, a people whose earthly songs still hold true. "I've been buked and I've been scorned, children. I've been talked about, shows you born." Nevertheless, these blues people reflect on this ongoing reality, even in this season of posts. The lament then moves to declaration. "Ain't gonna lay my religion down. No, ain't gonna lay my religion down." Thus, the religious life of the community is a grand part of the story. A contemporary blues people still sees merit in the experience of the full weight of cultural critic and activist and prolific novelist James Baldwin's words, as taken from his book of reflective essays, The Fire Next Time, when he states, quote, "If one is permitted to treat a group of people with special disfavor because of their race or the color of their skin, there is no limit to what one will force them to endure. And since the entire black race has been mysteriously indicted, no reason not to attempt to destroy it, root and branch," end quote. Against this backdrop, let us engage in a contemporary reflection on the racialized landscape that encouraged a distinct religious experience among African Americans. One reality is indeed clear. Blacks in this country over the last 100 years have sought and actively labored to secure wholeness in the face of social, political, cultural, and physical maltreatment. They have been forced to endure deathly experiential and social settings. I offer this idea of death as an idiom or a trope, framing the nature of African-American social placement, as I call it. That is, the framing of black bodies in light of physical and socio-political exploitation. In response to this death setting, I argue that certain form of religiosity emerges. Within this death experience, religious language and resulting racialized ideology are used against blacks. However, harmful religious language is simultaneously turned on its head and used to fortify and transform African-American life. I want to therefore emphasize features of religion that respond to racial oppression while proactively binding and fortifying community. My casting of religion does not deny the important elements of religious life that preclude the theological framing of religious faith that functionally emphasizes components such as personal piety or becoming closer to the divine or even eschatological hope. However, I want to isolate a certain function of religion and its utility in response to racial oppression. I am partly drawing on the argument of social death made by contemporary sociologist Orlando Patterson in connection to chattel slavery. As he conceives of it, black social death is a manifestation of the bondage of physical death awaiting the oppressed. In short, persons of African descent are racialized so as to be bound on all sides by death. They are, as J. Cameron Carter calls them, death-bound subjects. Death is seen either as physical or in terms of a commuted physical death sentence of cultural, social, and political death, which can be revoked at any time. Such a social milieu, I argue, was extended beyond slavery into the Reconstruction, Jim Crow, civil rights, and post-civil rights periods, which we find ourselves in now. These biopolitical subjects face death on all sides based upon their social status as other, and within a realm where law only acknowledged them in terms of an exclusion. These constricted bodies were bound in a chamber of death that closed in tightly with every attempt at agency or self-preservation. My argument acknowledges the importance of the concept of the scapegoat in relation to Black religio-political experience. The scapegoat was a human being who was considered pharmakos, that is, a symbol of curative healing. Ancient Athenians, for example, would regularly detain a number of degraded and useless citizens at the public expense. When calamities such as plague or drought or famine befell the city, they sacrificed two outcasts as scapegoats. This concept is expressed in the African-American context by way of representing them too as pharmakos in a culture of domination. Therefore, often as a backlash or reaction to African-American enfranchisement, such as legislative empowerment after the Civil War or post-Civil War constitutional amendments, whites would beat or lynch Blacks as scapegoats to bear, as it were, the perceived catastrophe of Black equality. Prejudged and indicted in this sociopolitical scene of death, African Americans were constantly reminded of the absence of justice. This political position ensnared African Americans in early 20th century as the prey of the dominant class. Blacks were simultaneously citizens and exceptions within hegemonic culture. Utilizing contemporary Italian social critic and philosopher Giorgio Agamben's argument in Homo Sacer, that is, the sacred man, these subjects are excluded from the community through a certain type of inclusion, which is defined by sovereign authority over their bodies. Thus, these excluded outcasts could not fully realize inclusion into society. This form of dual social positioning produced isomorphic forces of religion, or divine law on the one hand, and on the other hand, forces of politics, or divine or human law and order on the other hand, to press African Americans in a certain way. Black bodies, and by extension, most forms of Black social and cultural production, were being pressed into optimal position for control and social consumption. The mere fact that these forces were isomorphic speaks to the claimless state of Blacks who are considered, as I argue in my book, the coiled prey. That is, without a claim to justice on the basis of divine or moral law, Blacks are compressed into an encasement of death that would attempt to set the tone for their very existence and treatment. This double imposition of confinement remains the preeminently sui generis structure of social death for African Americans, even in contemporary times. Black life is truncated, Black agency is stifled, therefore the imposition of a death sentence, even if commuted, is made easy to carry out. Yet, amidst all this death talk, another reality emerges. In response to the deathly socio-political structure, religion came to function as a tool to secure healthier existence and carve out space, broadly defined. I again reflect on the words of James Baldwin, who states, quote, "What a writer is obliged at some point to realize is that he's involved in a language that he must change. For example, for a Black writer, especially in this country, to be born of the English language is to realize that the assumptions of that language, the assumptions at which that language operates, are his enemy," end quote. This engagement, as it were, with the enemy's language and the necessity to change that language thus thrust the second dialectical idea I seek to raise in this presentation. Religion points the death-bound subjects toward an alternative to the macabre state. Religion aids in creating a transformed subject who perpetually seeks wholeness of life. What grows within this reformed subject is a fortified language and expression of fuller life. The manifestations are seen within various religious black orientations and expressions, notably from within the black church. I emphasize the so-called black church based upon my own social location. Though from various sides of the track, my church family back in Houston would jointly acknowledge a God that has, quote, brought them from a mighty long way, end quote, and through, quote, toils and snares, end quote. These are the reflections of a blues people that become jazz-like expressions of faith. Another shameless plug for my good brother Heltzel's talk tonight. In spontaneous fashion, during a service last summer, an example of the current wrestling with harsh realities of life and in this age of posts was quite evident in my church. While the spirit was having its way and the frenzy of the church was high, my pastor, who had just taken the pulpit with every intention to preach, instead, in uncustomary fashion, belted out in song. And this is something that he very seldom did. His refrain echoed the lament of a blues man when all of a sudden he sang, I wouldn't have a religion I couldn't feel sometimes. At this, the congregation, already caught in the swell of spiritual emotion, latched onto those words as they reflected on their own hardships and faith in a benevolent God. The pastor continues, there's a man over the river giving sight to the blind. Now, stopping there would have been enough to send the church over the edge in celebration as they reflected on their experiences of God's power to heal and improve their dire social conditions. But the good pastor was by no means going to quench the spirit, as we say. He offered another nugget of God's power to preserve, heal, and make the wounded whole. In a final melodious exclamation, he sings, you talking about Jesus, he's a friend of mine. At this, the congregation just exploded. Everyone reflected on the intimate relationship with Jesus, the divine victor over evil and suffering. That morning, you would have witnessed several church mothers kicking off their shoes, men and women alike dancing in the aisles, random screams and shouts of simultaneous joy in triumph and lamenting in pain. Sweat and tears simultaneously roll down cheeks of many who find themselves overcome with the swell of spirit in the place. This little song would reverberate throughout the church of over 1,500 people, singing it together in what seemed a single thought in mind. God has and will make a way for a struggling people. This thought, in some sense, is the cornerstone of the hope of the black church, and I contend is sown into the religious thought of African Americans in general. But what is it about a blues people who seek a jazz-like expression, or as it were, as I call it, a gumbo-like expression of their humanity? Facing dehumanization and systems that sought the maintenance of social death, blacks required avenues to fully express life. This pursuit of healthy life options transitions into a lifestyle that I call recalibrational spirituality in my book. This spirituality maintains a posture of boundless expression. The task of recalibrating uses tools meant to harm and reshapes them in ways that transform a people who had been preyed upon by the white power structure. What results is a new selfhood and identity. Recalibration activity thus seeks to change the way the story of black religious life gets told. Religious language and ideas meant to stifle black progress is adjusted in transformative ways. It is recalibrated. The very machine of, say, Christianity, functioning according to the oppressor's specific calibrations, which maintain a culture of political domination, is restructured, sometimes in subtle ways, for use by the oppressed themselves. In the years leading up to the Obama presidency, the nature of black religious experience has therefore been a perpetual push toward the very conception of a black president. While the Obama presidency does not represent a capstone of black socio-political achievement, it is not the glorious symbol of post-race America. It may well point those who still suffer toward ideas of a greater sense of self-worth. I reflect on some of Martin Luther King's words from his mountaintop speech, which was given the night before his death, and I quote, "We are determined to be a people. We are saying that we are God's children and that we don't have to live like we are forced to live. It's all right to talk about long white robes up yonder and all its symbolism, but ultimately people want some suits and dresses and shoes to wear down here. It's all right to talk about streets flowing in gold, flowing in milk and honey, but God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his children who can't even eat 3 square meals a day. It's all right to talk about New Jerusalem, but one day God's preacher must talk about the New York, the New Atlanta, the New Philadelphia, the New Los Angeles, the New Memphis, Tennessee. This is what we have to do," end quote. King's prophetic words about what happens on the ground prompts me to reflect on the words of some young brothers from the south side of Chicago who were interviewed by NPR just after Obama's election into office. One brother said, quote, "Obama's president now, so we got to pull up our pants," end quote. Thereupon, the other brother said, "Yeah, we can't sag no more," quote, unquote. With respect to African-American religion, the sentiments of these young men reveal the nature of a personal inner striving in connection to the Obama presidency. Beyond the aesthetic in connection to the countercultural desire to snub dominant class, now pulling their pants up becomes a more appropriate way to navigate the same socio-political space. An Obama presidency transforms this countercultural behavior in the sense that Obama himself seems for them to represent an overriding countercultural figure to emulate, thus the pulling up of the pants. These young brothers, without knowing it, recalibrated cultural ideology to make it work for them. Formally juxtaposed against appropriate cultural aesthetic norms, where black youth often seem to reveal their unworthiness, these young men make use of these norms to reveal their full measure of reimagined humanity. Thus, tied to the declaration about no longer wearing sagging pants, hope is extended downward to the least of these of black society. Recalibrational religious action endeavors to change the socio-political structure with an intentional focus on the least of these. Black religion, at its best, will strive by way of the Obama presidency, with all of its historical, political, and cultural significance, to refocus the country's attention on the plight of the poor and oppressed. The Obama presidency is therefore not a culmination of the civil rights struggle. Rather, it represents an emboldened and hopeful starting point to finally establish the full worth and measure of all people right here on earth. Theirs is a jazz-like struggle in that it is complex. What results are the religious and political stories of a bluesy gumbo people whose worth and impact on American culture and religious history is now just beginning to be resounding. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Hicks. We have some time for Dr. Hicks to answer your questions, respond to your comments. If you have one, I'll come to you with the microphone if you could state clearly what your question is, and we'll get underway. Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Hicks, so very much. I'd like to know how you think religion needs to be recalibrated, in a post-race Obama presidency era for black folk, for black religion.
Well, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to get at is recalibration has to happen on various in various spheres, on various levels. That what I argue in my book relates to antebellum African Americans. That is, African Americans during slavery, African and African Americans during slavery, who sought by way of their particular reads of the biblical text a recalibrational posture, right, where they make the language that had been used against them within the Bible and the language that had been used against them in plantation churches by white plantation pastors, they made that biblical language and story work for them. It began to tell their stories as well. But I also argue that recalibration, it happens on various, again, in various spheres. So everything that African and African Americans have approached, especially with respect to religion and religious thought, becomes an opportunity to make the language speak more broadly about their own stories, right? So it's happening. What I'm trying to argue is that it's not solely a reactionary process, that this recalibrational activity, in order for it to be best understood, is understood as a proactive process, a perpetual process of continually framing one's own identity, the continually telling of one's own story. So it is internal. It offers within itself an internal critique of what the language is and should be amongst African Americans, but it also critiques power and attempts to speak truth to power by way of this recalibrational posture.
Is this recalibration, is this a conscious or an unconscious thing that happens within the community?
Yeah, now that's a great question, Keith, and a question of questions. I want to raise ideas in the book that this is an unconscious posture, that one's, in the Christian context, one who is oppressed, their position over and against and with the cross, or in relation to the Christ event, the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, is one that allows them to reframe their posture, change their posture over and against oppression, right? So I'm trying to move away from this kind of corporate liberation model that we find in black liberation theology, not to reject black liberation theology, but to try to offer a hermeneutical, historical, sociological approach to undergird the claims that Cohn and others within the black liberation theology camp make, right? So I'm arguing that it is an innate quality, that recalibrational positioning is active, ever-moving, ever-evolving, ever-growing, and something that if we know where to look and know how to look and know how to raise up the language of a people who are caught in a void because they were othered and silenced in very significant ways, I want to raise up this kind of natural inclination toward kind of the Foucauldian self, right? This idea that we want to present ourselves and tell our own stories as full human beings. Great question, though.
Thank you for your presentation. I thoroughly enjoy it. I wonder if you would consider the possibility of a different kind of recalibration within the black community, one that runs counter to the kind of reconstruction of the biblical narrative that responds to this call, sense of hope, responds to the needs of the least of these, a recalibration that is more informed by a kind of materialistic, very capitalist, name it, claim it theology that we see among the black middle class, upper middle class. Would you consider that another type of recalibration?
That is an absolute internal critique. That you're spot on. In my work, as it moves toward kind of contemporary considerations, I plan on applying this idea of recalibration to two principal kind of dispensations, if I can speak in my old Dallas terminology, but I'm not using progressive dispensational ideology here, but two particular recalibrational dispensations. That is hip-hop culture, which will likely be book number two, Lord willing, that within hip-hop culture there is a recalibrational spirituality, a language that is on the ground that ain't coming out of the church, right? I'm not speaking of Christian rap. What I'm speaking of is this recalibrational spirituality that we find in, and maybe I'm stuck in 90s hip-hop, that we find in places and spaces out of Atlanta, early Outkast. Most notably, the first two CDs from Goody Mob and CeeLo Green, right? When he's saying that y'all better realize, speaking of black people and black youth most notably, y'all better realize that we losing this fight. Right, that the devil wants you to be that Uncle Sam wants you to be a devil too, that you lose the sight of the fact that the slave ships had, and these are his words, thousands of us on board, but we were still praising the Lord. But now y'all want to die over a coat, necklace around your throat, and then he cusses, so I can't say that in here. But but he says, y'all better GD realize that you losing your spirit. And you need to get your spirit and your mind back, right? So that's one element. But I think that navigates a space that sets a trajectory for also a critique of the contemporary church, black church, wherein, as Dr. Heltzel and I have discussed, and you know, some others who were here this past week, we discussed that, as Lou Powery said, that we need to restore, and now Luke Powery on Saturday was speaking in terms of the preaching moment, that the preacher needs to restore this blues people dialogue and dialectic, right? That there's a sense in which an internal critique has to happen so that we can unearth stories that are being blotted out by naming and claiming stuff going on. So, yes, I do believe that recalibration needs to take place internally, and my brother Peter Heltzel is perhaps a bit more optimistic than I that it's coming sooner rather than later.
Muchas gracias, hermano. Thank you so much for those. What really struck a core for me from a liberation theology and as a Latina, the aspect of the assumption of the English language. Mm. And it strikes a chord because in the Latino cultures, and I put that S, big S, there, we have that phenomenon in which English is imposed to us. Mm-hmm. And if you want to make it in this country, religious country, you better speak the language and speak it well.
Right.
So I want to hear more from that, together with the aspect of the transformational subject that in liberation theology in Latin America we speak much about.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful question. One of the things that I'll start with Baldwin, and then I'll move back. So Baldwin, when he makes this claim, he's making it audibly he was at UC Berkeley giving a lecture in early 1980s or actually 1970s. And what I don't mention, and that for those of you who have been in my class, you've seen me show this clip, is he moves on to talk about, I had to really think about, as a black youth, what it meant to be black as sin, black as death, black-hearted, right? All of these conceptual frameworks and conceptualizations of what it means to be black and how they're continually cast in negative ways. And he goes on to compare that to his first reading of Othello. I'm a Shakespeare man, and so I was an English major, so I was kind of forced to be a Shakespeare man. but I do enjoy Hamlet, Macbeth, and Othello most principally. And he speaks about Othello at the point of killing Desdemona. Right after he kills Desdemona, he says, "I have thrown away a pearl greater than all my tribe." Now, of course, Othello was the Moor of Venice, and Iago was the his white Venetian secondhand man who wanted this, who did not feel this Moor needed to be in such a position of authority in Venice, right? And Baldwin says, it struck me, he said, wait a minute, I threw away a pearl greater than all my tribe? This idea that what was lost, while tragic, was greater than anything that he had come from in terms of dark-skinned peoples. Now, changing of language. And I do this in the book, when I think in terms of the slavery moment in North America, one of the things that I'm fascinated by are the states that went so far as to put law on the books so that African and African-American slaves were kept from being literate, from learning to read, right? It's not as though those who had been drawn from West African shores were illiterate. It's just that they did not speak English, right? And so we're speaking about a language of domination that is now being held, kept away from those who are being dominated. But at the same time, there is this internal and external critique of the dominated class because they can't handle the language, right? They're kept from it, and then once they have it, let's fast forward now, they're being critiqued because they can't handle it. I also look at Frantz Fanon's pivotal work in Dark Skin, White Masks, and in The Wretched of the Earth, where he talks about his experience as an African colonized by French and what it means to take upon the French language, to speak the correct King's English, if we were to cast it in terms of the United States, and what that does diabolically, even amongst African Americans, so as to be critiqued. One African American might be critiqued because they sound white, right? They're understood as nerdy because they read too much, right? And so language becomes a very interesting and clever game used on both sides, because you've got to have the internal critique that because I speak a certain way doesn't project me as being against my race, so to speak, but also the need to construct language so as to stand on one's own conviction and be fully human when language is being used against you. Yeah.
Dr. Hicks, I want to apologize for missing much of your lecture. We have these things called CVR2s.
Hallelujah. I know CVR1s quite well. Yes.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, given what I did here and the conversation you're having right now, I'm wondering what you make. This is a systems analysis that I want you to think about. While black / Africana people are recalibrating how they are going to be in the system, how do you imagine the system is recalibrating itself to maintain its dominance?
In the book, I kind of take that up, that recalibrational activity is not kind of in the lap of one community. That there, and that's why I'm saying it's ever moving, ever progressing. It is reactive and proactive simultaneously, because there is a legitimate argument that can be made that as I recalibrate, I'm being recalibrated against. I mean, right, it's taking up the Charles Long significations argument, but recasting it in a different way. That the signifier signifies, and the signified resignifies. But at the same time of my resignification, the signifier comes up with new significations, right? And so there, what's that? Changing the language and the rules. The changing of language and rules becomes the principal language game. And the language game, I'm arguing, can be addressed and entertained by multiple communities. And Black folk have, with ingenuity, engaged in this and continually have to engage in it because of what they, because of the responses they get from those who want to maintain domination.
Dr. Hicks, it's good to hear you again, and I want to thank you very much for your symposium last week.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, it was powerful, and I'm still trying to put a lot of things together. And I don't remember exactly what day, but the New York Times just had an article with, and I'm sure, I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Loud.
The conversation being that he made the statement, the Black church is dead. And this article also quoted Cone, as well as a number of renowned African-American ministers who responded quite harshly to his statement. But one of the things that comes to mind in reflecting on last week is that idea that we've always been our religious expression, our spiritual expression has always had a sense of pluralism to it, or syncretic is what how Monica Coleman lifted up. And so I hear you saying that it has to be recalibrated on multiple levels. How do you guys begin to have this conversation though? With where's the bridge? How does this bridge happen? Because I think the church fails to realize that itself, or won't acknowledge it, and I think it's just critical for the life and the health of the Black church that you guys can talk some kind of way in ways that are that recalibrates in life-giving ways.
Mm. Now, when you say the bridge between
the church, the academic and the church, mm-hmm. and because I think that article kind of sets it off as two camps, and that wasn't helpful at all. But it just seems like what is being done or what could be done, or because that I think that too has to be a part of the recalibration activity that needs to happen. Yeah.
And I would add to that, and it seems like you hinted at this. Also, the bridge, the interfaith bridge, right? This dialogue amongst African Americans about religion writ large, right? Because I was raised to think that we were all Christian, Black folk, right? And I was raised in the Watts section of Los Angeles, California. Everybody I knew went to church. Even the gangsters went to church, and Baptists. Well, or Methodist, you know, you, it's okay to be Methodist as well. And holiness was a little bit out there. We didn't know how to speak Kojic. We just called everybody holiness. They all holiness. But I think that is one of the crux of the challenges. And you mentioned the symposium. What I tried to do, and what I will continually try to do, and kind of improve upon the lessons and draw from the lessons I learned from this first one, is to infuse it with different stuff. People speaking at different levels, right? So I had Lamar Darnell Shields, who most of his work is on the ground stuff, where he's trying to pull church folk in to have this conversation with him. But he's really addressing the kid who just cussed out his mother or who just shot somebody, right? He's literally with those folks. But the irony with him is, while he's not an academic, he was called by Johns Hopkins to teach three classes and regularly lectures at Johns Hopkins. He didn't ask them. They called him because they we're aware of the type of work he does. So I think there are models. While even as we've been discussing some of the essentialist claims made by the documentary, right, about men raising boys and whether or not single mothers can do it, I think one of the ways that the Academy needs to approach this is kind of similar to what Dr. Anthony Penn, my advisor at Rice, promoted at the close of his talk, and that is actual programs that promote synergy between institutions and community. So community is not simply a laboratory that institutions send their students to go out and fact find and data collect and draw from and then hold it and hide it and run back to the institution and come up with solutions and claim that this is the nature of what happens on the community, right? That happens, but there's more of a synergy that folk in the community also are drawn into the institution to become a part of this process and contribute to the livelihood and academic discussion of the community, which means what? It means that we've got to reframe or change the language of what it means to be an academic. That perhaps we might be able to learn something of substance from folk who don't have PhDs, but who have been doing this work and addressing the very problems that we theorize in our books. So, yes, I think those are some, that's an absolute need. Yeah.
These are important topics. The conversation's been rich, but we've run out of time. So let's thank Dr. Hicks one more time.
Thank you.